Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. In a couple of weeks, Penn State will host the Project Drawdown Conference. It's based on a book that outlines the 100 top actions to reverse climate change. We talk with two conference presenters about drawdown and the research they're doing into fighting global warming. Dr. Erica Smithwick is a professor of geography at Penn State, as well as an associate director of the Institutes of Energy and Environment at Penn State. Dr. Esther Abonio is an associate professor of engineering design and architectural engineering at Penn State, and the director of the Global Building Network. Thank you both for talking with me.
Thank you.
First, can you tell us a little bit more about the Project Drawdown concept?
Sure. Project Drawdown was initially founded by Paul Hawken. He's an environmentalist, activist, entrepreneur. Some might recognize his name from the company Smith & Hawken. He developed a number of companies over the years. But what he was interested in was developing solutions to climate change, to not just talk about it as a problem, but to try to identify solutions that could be scalable at a global scale. So the 100 solutions that are being put forward by Project Drawdown are an effort to do that, to quantify them, to scale them at across the Earth so that we can actually make progress towards this challenge.
And they're sort of divided up into different types of solutions too, right?
Yes. So this is Esther. I'm from the built environment. I'm actually very excited about the Project Drawdown because for the first time, a group of us are now participating in a more broadly defined conversation. It's not just the built environment trying to pull different disciplines into our efforts to use more sustainable solutions and technologies, but we are also in a position now to learn from the other sectors either directly because we are interconnected, or indirectly by seeing like, oh, this is what is happening in the agricultural sectors. We could adapt this and use it in our own sector.
One sector in particular, women and girls, might be a surprising one for a lot of people to see as one of the areas of solutions. So educating girls and family planning are ranked as numbers 6 and 7 in the drawdown list.
Yeah, well, this is Erica. Global population is expected to get to 11.2 billion by 2100, over 9 billion by 2050. So the population question is one that we really need to be addressing as part of a climate change solution, as not only do those people grow in number, but there are demands for resources on the earth also grow. So understanding population through the role of women's and women's rights is one part of that question. Another part is empowering women on a daily basis to make sound decisions in their own lives, whether that's tending a household garden or their decisions about education and how they're going to spend their lives. And that is a question that we need to engage with if we're going to actually create the holistic solutions that Esther was talking about just now.
Mm-hmm. And this is Esther. I would like to add to that. So from an applications perspective, again, the built environment, this is a very male-dominated profession. Mm-hmm. And we were recently discussing at a conference how, from a homemaker perspective, the views of the family are rarely factored into the design and the construction of buildings. So I think it's important the effort to invest in empowering and educating women to even start using examples that homemakers can relate to. Because in some of the places, the problems are related to indoor air quality. Mm. The women and the girls who are going to become mothers are in a very unique position to inform the social nuances of designing and drawing down solutions to the home level.
And they're probably spending the most time in the home.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Dr. Smithwick, you've said in interviews you like to focus on wicked problems.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like these are problems that are so complex that society hasn't figured out what to do about them. It seems like this would be a lot of wicked problems that are focused on in this conference.
I wish I didn't have to focus on wicked problems. They're hard. But that's what makes them interesting. And what I enjoy out of that is that you are bringing people together who have very different perspectives and viewpoints and contributions to those solutions, hopefully. So what we are trying to do within the breadth of Project Drawdown and trying to pick apart these solution spaces to solve the wicked challenges, we're really bringing communities together, we're bringing stakeholders together, and we're having a conversation about where we want to be, what is the state of the earth in a decade or two decades. And so that's what excites me about those wicked challenges.
You focus a lot on forests. Several of the drawdown entries are about forests. Why are forests so important?
So a recent report by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has put forward a whole report about the importance of land and land use in the climate change conversation. And it turns out that land use is about 23% of the total total anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, so at least a quarter of these emissions. So understanding the role of forests in regulating the exchange of gases between the land surface and the atmosphere is a really fundamental role of understanding forests. Forests also provide a number of other ecosystem services, of course, including biodiversity, water storage, water regulation, traditional foods, traditional medicines, and are part of a cultural resource as well. So there's many reasons to understand the value of forests.
And you work with the Menominee Tribe in northern Wisconsin using virtual reality. And so we've got a native tribe there and virtual reality. Tell me about how that works.
We're working on a National Science Foundation project, working in partnership with the Menominee. The Menominee have a very robust sustainable forestry practice that supports the economics of their tribe. What we are doing right now is actually trying to understand the role of adaptation in the context of climate change. So as forest species change, should those forest managers adapt? Should they plant new kinds of tree species? Should they manage their forests differently? But the thing is that it's not just about the forest. It's also about those other ecosystem services. It's about the cultural value of the forest. It's about the aesthetics of being in a forest. And so we're actually using virtual reality as a way to feel more engaged in that decision-making process. And so we feel if we use virtual reality to immerse people of all kinds, Menominee and non-Menominee, into forests of the future, we feel that they'd be able to make better decisions now.
If you see, okay, if you make this decision, maybe the forest looks beautiful, and if you make this decision, maybe the forest is wiped out. Talking about forests, you also work on fires. So the two together, I mean, I can't help but think of the Amazon, all that we're seeing about the Amazon burning right now. You know, what are the effects that we can expect from that?
Right. So we have over 2.2 million acres burning in the Amazon. It's an 80% increase from previous years. So it's very devastating. One of the concerns for the tropics is that these systems are not adapted to that scale of fire. And so they usually are a moist place, right? Traditionally, people used to burn in a very sustainable way, and fire was part of a forestry practice that could be sustainable. But increasingly, we have large agriculture coming in. Increasingly, there are policies in place that say people have to burn the land in order to have rights to it. And so these kinds of policies are promoting a deforestation that is actually quite unsustainable. There are other ecosystems that are fire-prone as well. Right now in Alaska, we've had a large fire year, not the largest in recent memory, but one of the largest, equal in size, almost exactly the same area that's also burning in Alaska. And that's about the size of Yellowstone. So think of a Yellowstone burning in Alaska and a Yellowstone burning in the Amazon. So we have all of this emissions from these fires impacting the atmosphere and at some level contributing to the increased carbon in the atmosphere. However, if those fires are within the natural system's norm, you know, the bounds of how that system normally operates, we'd expect that carbon to come back and be sequestered, we call it, back into the biomass of the forest. But when we keep burning and we don't allow the forest to recover, that's when we really have the net negative impact onto climate change.
Because that carbon sequestration is the real concern. I've seen some people talking about how the Amazon is the lungs of the world, and it's more about that carbon.
It's more about the net loss of carbon, right? So carbon will come, carbon will go. Plants are breathing, you know, all the time. And so this exchange, and in fact, if you see it's called the Keeling curve, and you see this uptick in carbon in the atmosphere, you see these wiggles in the curve, and that's the breathing of the land. And so that breathing of the land is happening all the time. But when we totally change the type of land that we have. So, for example, if the tropical forest burns so much that it turns into a cerrado or a savanna-like woodland system, then we have a very different carbon stock to begin with. In my own research, we're finding that to be a potential threat in a place like Yellowstone. Ironically, I just mentioned that as the size of the area. But in our work in Yellowstone, that system is used to severe wildfires. That's a historically, for the past 10,000 years, it used to burn every 150 to 300 years. But when we start burning it as severely as we might in this climate change kind of situation where it's more vulnerable to that lightning strike, we're getting fires that are going to come at every 15 to 30 years. And the forest might not be able to recover at that point. And then we've gone from a high carbon stock forest to a low carbon stock woodland. And that's where we see a net impact to the atmosphere.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. Penn State professors Dr. Esther Obonyo and Dr. Erica Smithwick will be a part of the upcoming Project Drawdown Conference at Penn State. The conference looks at the most effective solutions to climate change. Dr. Obonyo, about 40% of global emissions are associated with buildings. You focus on greener building materials. They call you the brick lady.
Yes, that's correct.
So what makes bricks a green option?
So it's not every brick. Actually, maybe I'll back up a little and start the story from the beginning.
Okay.
I picked brick as a case study because it's small enough for us to be able to do testing at different scales without wasting so much materials. And I initially gravitated, again, at that point, towards the bricks that minimize the use of cement. In the built environment, the cement industry is actually the main culprit as far as greenhouse gas emissions are concerned. And there are some concerns among people who are like now the home builders, especially in the formal sector, that when we minimize the use of cement, the quality of the building is going to be compromised. So we started looking at ways of, you know, generating data and trying to understand what would cause premature deterioration and also address some of the social-economical concerns that people have. A lot of it is around the space of introducing what is a traditional material back into the equation because people built using adobe bricks. People have done this, similar to what Erica was saying about the forest, that there is a natural, in this case, human-built system that has worked for very many years, but we've shifted and gone into use of more concrete-based materials and trying to get people to be comfortable with things which we know that our great-great-grandparents used.
And why is cement problematic?
It starts with the extraction process, that if you went to a company that's producing cement and you saw how they do the extraction, we'll actually overlap with Erica in terms of the damage to land, land that is naturally a forest or an agricultural land. By the time they're done with the explosives, it's going to be a new way of, you'll have to think about a new way of using the land. And then there's also the fact that the burning to turn the limestone into the powder that's got the cementitious material, it uses a lot of energy, but it also releases a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So every step of the way from the extraction of the natural material, processing it, sometimes the transportation, and then when the building is finally not needed anymore, we demolish it. A lot of the demolition waste is going to end up in the landfills again.
And I've been hearing about a shortage of sand as well.
Mm-hmm. So we are consuming most of the natural resources that we use in building. We are consuming them at a much faster rate than they can be replenished. We are breaking the rules of the natural system, as Erica pointed once more, that when we look at the numbers of how much cement or how much sand was used in 1970 and how much we are using now, it's gone up by more than, some estimates are saying more than 70%. And we just cannot sustain that. We are going to run out of natural resources that we need. Even timber. We use a lot of timber in construction. The rate at which, you know, timber products are being used in construction projects is not sustainable.
But I do think it's interesting. Brick, it seems like such a simple material. When we think of green buildings, I think we think of solar panels or other advanced building materials. What's the benefit of having the focus be on something that is sort of a simpler material?
I think one of the reasons why I continue to focus on it, not predominantly but largely, it's because a lot of the residential buildings, if you look at the stock of residential buildings in the world, brick is one of the main building material for residential construction. So it is very important to pay attention to what materials are being used in the commercial building sector. And we would like to see more conversations about the materials that are currently being used for residential construction. The two top materials are bricks and timber. Wood stick construction in the U.S. is going to be one of them. It's for the foreseeable future, people are going to be building their houses using wood stick construction. And in many countries, we are going to be using bricks. It's not going to change anytime soon. The type of bricks that's used in most of the formal housing sectors is burnt bricks. And they contribute to greenhouse gases emission during the production again.
Because so not all bricks are good.
Yes, they are fired at very high temperatures. So there's an opportunity there to also do more research, which we're beginning to look at, to lower the firing temperatures.
And Dr. Smithwick, you've worked with Penn State graduate students through a program called Landscape U. I hear they're actually going to visit the new Penn State solar panel farm to see one of the potential drawdown solutions at work. What's the goal of that Landscape U program?
Yeah, this is a really exciting program. We just have our first cohort of graduate students coming in starting this year, and we do plan very exciting field trips all over the Pennsylvania landscape, including to solar farms and energy infrastructure all over the state. The focus on the program is on understanding one of these wicked problems, the food, energy, water nexus, and having students really try to explore the challenges of managing a landscape from all those different perspectives, so that we're not just training them to do energy or to do water or to do food, but rather to train them to think holistically about how do we manage a landscape where all of those things are important. So we are using a transdisciplinary approach so that we're actually hoping to have the students learn from stakeholders on the ground, people who run those businesses, NGOs, managers themselves, you know, what are your challenges in the food, energy, water nexus, and then hoping that the students can engage in research that will help with those solutions on the ground. So we're very excited about it.
And I was interested to see that the drawdown book says the number one thing that could make an impact on global warming is refrigerants management. So think of refrigerators, air conditioners. This actually seems like something that global warming is making worse in our world. It's hotter. I need an air conditioner. Talk about that number one. I think that's so interesting. I mean, it's so boring, but so interesting.
We are familiar with it, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a fridge. I think this is a really interesting one to have listed as number one. And I think the reason it is not only does it have a significant amount of impact, but also it's scalable. So as we were talking about Project Drawdown earlier, it's not just that what is the one thing we can do, but it's what's the one thing that's going to have the most impact across the world that we can scale rapidly. And refrigeration is one of those things that we have kind of an innate understanding of, and we use it in our daily lives. And as the world develops, it's become more important. And as you say, as it continues to warm. And so if you create a solution about refrigeration, and then it can scale at that level, at the human level, and at the sort of global society level, then it's likely to have more impact.
Yeah, so from the built environment perspective, we intersect with that, with the need for cooling, air conditioning inside a house. And even though it may sound like, you know, really, can that be true? Countries in the global south, countries which are characterized as developing economies, they have a segment of the population that has the disposable income that allows them to buy air conditioning. And unfortunately, the market that they are tapping into is China. And a lot of the products that are being sold in Kenya, for example, which is my home country, they would not pass the standards that are required for energy efficiency for sale in the U.S. So I think I see that as a growing problem, that as more young urban professionals aspire to improve their quality of life, they will invest in refrigeration for their own domestic use or air conditioning that is not energy efficient at all.
And Dr. Smithwick, we talked about an example with Starbucks. Tell me about that.
Well, this is an idea that companies like Starbucks, right, and this is an example, but it's scalable. They have needs for cooling, right? You have to have your latte, you know, with some milk in it, but you also have to heat the coffee. And so there are companies that are investing in circular systems that, you know, use the energy that released from the cooling process to actually put into the heating. That's a much smarter way of going about things than having to have separate sources for both and then your waste on both ends. So it's an example of how we can invest in sort of no-brainer kind of solutions. We just need a little engineering and we need a little know-how, and then it needs to scale, right? So my understanding is Starbucks knows how to do this. It's just how does it get it all in all of its stores all over the country and the world.
And does scale include being affordable?
Right. And so how does it also be affordable? I mean, obviously there's energy savings, but there's some engineering cost up front. And do you take out all the old systems and put in the new, and then you get into the stuff that Esther would be, you know, thinking about in terms of the demolition costs and, you know, where is the footprint for that? So those solutions exist, and we need smart people like people at Penn State and others to be thinking about, you know, looking at the same problem from a different perspective and thinking about new solutions.
Mm-hmm. And this is Esther, just to, you know, add on to what my colleague Erica has shared, and going back even to maybe something she said much earlier about the need to have transdisciplinary eyes. I could not overemphasize that point, that a lot of times we push one solution and then realize 10, 15, maybe even sooner than that, years later, that there were some undesirable consequences that were not taken into consideration, that when you're shifting people from what they're doing currently, it's not start and stop. It's an optimization problem. There are trade-offs. And we have to always step back and think about all the different pieces of the puzzle that are holding this. If it is an engineering solution, we never say it's perfect. We say it's optimized. Yeah, and if you move one piece, something else is going to give. And you have to have a clear understanding that, you know, I have to pay a price to have this thing adopted.
That's well said. And if I could just add to that, this is Erica again, that I mentioned that land use has a 23% net emissions. But if you think of land use actually associated with food, right, and some of the agricultural land uses in there, but the whole food production system involves shipping and all these other production, and then the number goes up to 37%. Right. So they're not separated. It's part of the same system. And so if you affect in the land use sector, you're going to affect the food system as well.
And if you're building, you're affecting the land use sector.
Yes. So yes, exactly.
So that's a benefit of this conference, bringing together people from these different areas to talk.
Different scientific disciplines, but it's not just scientists. It's also people who are in positions in businesses and NGOs. I'm hosting a panel on indigenous knowledges and sort of ways of knowing. That's kind of what we're talking about, is different ways of seeing the system, ways of knowing. And so those voices are critical as well as we.
Mm-hmm. And one group of stakeholders who are included in the conference are policymakers, and some would argue even the politicians. If we think about a lot of these problems, they are experienced in cities, in communities, you know, small towns, and the policymakers can help to promote policy, you know, urban planning or rural development or infrastructure development policies that will protect the environment. Going back to the land use example, when we start dealing up with a population that's exploding, we're already feeling the impact that the cities are very congested. So when we look at it from a land use or conserving the natural ecosystem, we would say, you know, no, don't do that. We want to say that. But then at the same time, we're like, you know, the cities are exploding. Yeah, we have to start optimizing and thinking about, you know, do we want to grow vertically? If we are growing vertically, we need more steel. If we're going to run out of steel, do we grow horizontally? You know, so it's a wicked problem, really. It's like you're going to have to be comfortable with a few things which are not ideal. But if you talk to enough different groups of people, you can be very close to being certain that almost everybody's needs have been taken into account to the extent that is possible.
It seems like the climate, if you will, for dealing with global warming is not a good one. President Trump has pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, loosening regulations on methane emissions, which is a major greenhouse gas. You know, how does that affect your work? Does it make it harder?
Yes. It does make it harder because there's less, obviously it affects us because there's less funding to go out there and study this. That's one problem. But I think the real issue is that it's creating an environment in which people feel disempowered to actually make a change. And so we'd rather have the inverse. We'd rather have leaders embolden us to really create the energy that it will take to make this change. Because again, it's across all of these sectors. And so when you don't have the policies in place and you don't have leaders that will speak to what is needed, then you kind of have a double whammy there. And then, unfortunately, then what's also happening is that the industries that are causing the problem are getting enhanced rather than the ones that can help support with solutions. And so there's a number of different places where we're not heading in the right direction. Mm-hmm. But other countries are, and there are good solutions out there. And what we really need is probably some activism from the bottom up to say, listen, leaders respond to what the people say ultimately, over long periods of time. And so that's what we need to work on right now.
So I wanted to add on to what Erica, it is definitely a challenging time to do work in this space. In fact, half of the times they're like, which is the right word to use? Do we say climate change, extreme weather events? Yeah. But then from a global perspective, I've spent the last maybe 4 or 5 years being very active in building global partnerships, working in science diplomacy. I spent 1 year working in DC as a Jefferson Science Fellow. And I see an opportunity there because it's a global problem. And our environment may not be favorable within the US, but because it is a global problem, it gives us an opportunity to honestly and genuinely reach out to people who are in places where the political leadership is more supportive of the drawdown solutions and environmentally friendly technologies and forge true strategic partnerships. We can do experiments in the global south, we can do experiments in Ireland, we can do experiments in Germany or any country in the world if we think about science as a global movement that can help address the global problems. The global wicked problems.
and the drawdown solutions aren't just about solving climate, right? Because there's many co-benefits that would come along with that, independent of climate, right? Supporting women is good for lots of other reasons mm-hmm. than just carbon.
And what do you hope the ultimate outcome of this conference will be?
Well, we would like Penn State, frankly, to start to do more of this work, to convene these kinds of things moving forward. We don't think this is the end of it. It's not like we have a conference and we go home. It's the beginning of a conversation. So we hope there are new collaborations that develop from this at a sort of micro levels, small groups of people getting new research ideas. Or new application ideas, but also that we can grow the network so that, whether Penn State hosts the next conference or is helping to lead it, that we can sort of continue to move forward.
Mm-hmm. And to add on to that, this is Esther. I would like to see opportunities for creating the network effect, not just growing the network, because if one person or one institution is championing the initiative, they will grow, but at a much slower pace. I would like to see possibilities beyond what we can do as an individual university. We want to see more things that are on the multiplier effect. Like, how do you do that? How do you do that one thing that results in something going viral? Mm-hmm. Yeah. How can Penn State be the trigger or contribute to that trigger that results in us hitting that 1 million mark? And then we can even start drawing a pathway to 1 billion.
Impacting 1 million or 1 billion people.
Yeah, so it can be different things. It can be 1 billion houses. Mm. It can be, 1 billion houses may be possible. 1 billion people.
Fish.
1 billion fish. 1 billion trees.
Trees.
Yeah, 1 billion acres of land.
Thank you both so much for talking with me.
Our pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Penn State professors Dr. Esther Obonio and Dr. Erica Smithwick will be a part of the Project Drawdown Conference at Penn State on September 16th through 18th. The conference looks at the most effective solutions to climate change. You can hear more Take Note interviews at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Emily Reddy, WPSU.